You're listening to The Writer's Voice on Virginia Voice. I'm Jennifer Robbins, your host today. Our guest today is local author Bruce Mattson. Bruce practices law in Richmond and serves as director of Apple Reek Companies, C.S. Lewis Institute, and as an executive officer and director of the Virginia State Golf Association. I'm honored you're here today, Bruce. Thank you for being with us. What an interesting book, Bruce. The book is called The Race Before Us, A Journey of Running and Faith. I'd like to start out with your quote in the beginning of the book. Let us run with perseverance the race that is set before us. Hebrews 12, verse 1. Why did you pick this quote, and how did you come up with the title for your book? It's such a great one.
Well, thanks. Of course, the title comes right from that piece of scripture. There's a kind of a play on the scripture here because the idea of the race is a very common metaphor in scripture. St. Paul uses it in a number of places. This one from Hebrews just lent itself nicely to this title. There's kind of two aspects to it, because when you understand what the race is, the race is actually how do we live our lives once we become Christians.
Oh, and I didn't know that.
How are we doing in the race is really, how are we doing, you know, becoming better disciples, living closer the way Jesus lived. But in a way, this book is about my questions of doubt and figuring out if what I did believe. So in some ways, the book is a race to faith. And then upon the resolution of those issues, the race before us continues to be, how do we best, you know, live our lives as Christians once we accept the truth of Christianity?
Okay, very interesting. So this is basically your memoir, Bruce, and it's quite a good one. You talk about hitting the wall, so to speak, and how it prompted a series of events that led to a serious health check. Can you tell our listeners about that and your inspiration behind writing this particular book?
I guess in some ways this is my midlife crisis. Happened as I was turning 50, and it was coming all along. It's kind of like a train wreck, you know, that you see coming. And I worked pretty hard, but I let my health slide, and I was overweight. I fully expected that when I finally decided I needed to do something, you know, that I was going to go to the doctor, and he was going to tell me I had high blood pressure, high cholesterol, and I was overweight. And he did, but then he said, no, you're obese. And that was didn't like hearing that, but I should have known. I should have known that was the case. And it really bothered me because my whole life I was an athlete. I always thought of myself that way. And to think of myself being terribly out of shape, obese, was terrible. So that was hitting the wall physically, and I had sleep apnea, and I had all of these other issues, and I kind of knew about it for quite some time, but I just never did anything about it. I finally was turning 50, and I finally sort of hit the wall, so to speak, and said, look, I've got to do something about this. And I hadn't been to the doctor since I got a physical for college. It'd been 30
years.
Oh, wow.
30 years?
Yeah.
Wow. So how did you get into the mindset of making running a priority? Sometimes that's the hardest step, getting started and sticking with something, whether it's a new project or making a commitment to someone or a cause. So what did you do?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. I mean, there's a practical part of it, and I often hear people saying to me, that's quite an accomplishment in terms of the running. How did you ever do it? Well, I kind of heard myself when people would ask that question, because I said that to others. You know, I'm too busy. How do you ever find time
to do this? You can always make
this?
Excuses, yeah.
And we do always make excuses. And in this process, something someone told me once really rang true, and I've used it since there, which is, I am convinced that we all do what we want to do. And we say we don't have time to do things, but we all do what we want to do. And as a practical matter, the only thing I really did, other than making a commitment, and that's pretty significant, was I got up an hour earlier, and I created that space of time that allowed me to get out on the streets and start running. So other than recognizing I was in a terrible physical shape,
right,
knowing I needed to do something, hoping that I would live longer than I was looking at,
right,
figuring that I was going to develop type 2 diabetes, I knew I needed to do something. And by as simple as it was, by getting up an hour earlier, all of a sudden I had enough time that I could do all those things that I thought were keeping me too busy, but also fit in the exercise, and which was primarily running.
So you made it a priority.
Yeah,
basically.
Clearly I did.
You weren't going to have it any other way.
Yeah, that's the way I felt, and I did, but I had done it before. I mean, I had made it this once and for all. I'm going to finally do this, and mm-hmm. I had failed, so I was mindful of that too. But I think that I had sort of hit the wall insufficiently that I was running out of time.
Well, sometimes when you're pushed against the wall and you're running out of time, you have to do something. When was the pivotal moment when you started to question your faith?
Well, I actually recounted in the book. It was just a moment, actually, in church. I go to a Lutheran church, and we read the Apostles or the Nicene Creed every week. And it says, I believe this, and I believe that. And sometimes I'm afraid we kind of go through it in a very rote way and don't even pay too much attention to the words. And I was paying attention to the words, and it just dawned on me, I really wondered if I really believed all of the things that were set forth in the creed, and was that something that I really believed? And it really troubled me, because I don't really want to do anything where I don't have the honesty or integrity about what I'm saying or what I'm doing. So that was really it caused me to start going on what you would call the spiritual or the faith part of this journey.
Tell us about your day with the King and what it meant to you in your spiritual journey.
Well, it didn't mean too much in terms of the spiritual journey, except it was an example, and it really tied into that idea of integrity. You know, we need to be who we are, and you know, when you talk about your beliefs and your values, you need to own these and really believe them. And it dawned on me when I was thinking about the fact that how could I say things if I didn't believe them, and I wanted to make sure I could. And it just made me think of my experience with Mr. Palmer, because I had the privilege of writing a book on the history of the Bay Hill Club, which is owned by the Palmer family. And that's how I got an opportunity to spend a number of days with Mr. Palmer. And I had this one day where, you know, people always ask me, what's he like? You know, everyone wants to know, what are celebrities like when the camera's not on them? And I know I've seen both. And when I look back at Mr. Palmer, I saw a day where he was sort of invaded by a number of people and who were irritants. In my way of thinking, they were irritants because I was with him and they were interfering with what he and I were trying to do. And he had lots of opportunities to sort of let his guard down, to say something unkind, and he never did. And, you know, people love him, and he is who he appears to be when the lights are on and when the lights aren't on. And that kind of integrity was the type of integrity I wanted to have. And that's why I used that little story about, you know, are we the same person, you know, when mm-hmm. no one's looking?
Oh, okay. I didn't know he was referred to as the King.
Well, if you were a golfer a little bit older, you would know that
he
is the King in golf.
He's the King of golf. That's right. You're listening to The Writer's Voice on Virginia Voice, and I'm Jennifer Robbins, your host today. Our guest today is local author Bruce Mattson, and the book is called The Race Before Us. What was it like when you finished your first marathon, and how did you feel physically and mentally? Just how many marathons have you run to this day?
Well, the last question's easiest. I've run 10 marathons.
Wow, that's fantastic.
I ran 2 in college, and I've run 8 in the last 6 years. So I view the marathon I ran now at the end of this new journey as my first marathon. Now, I won't even make reference really to those ones in college.
Wow.
So my first one I think of as that one in 2007 when I finally went on this running journey and spiritual journey. And literally, in January of 2007, I couldn't run a mile. And I signed up for the 10K training team, hoping that I could, you know, use, because I knew I needed to do something. I kind of liked running. And the miracle is that 11 months later, it was 11 months later, I ran the New York City Marathon.
And
wow. So how did I feel? There's a photograph of me crossing the finish line, which I paid for and have framed, as all of those races offer you many opportunities to buy pictures. But there's this tiny little, I can see it, I think people who know me can see it, there's this tiny little grin of satisfaction as I crossed it. So I had an enormous sense of satisfaction that I actually had covered, you know, the 26 miles, and I was still standing.
Wow.
And I didn't feel too bad. I managed the race pretty well for my ability, but I'm a slow runner. You know, it still took me almost 5 hours to complete. But I hit the wall. Hitting the wall in the running world is reaching a point where the glycogen in your muscles is exhausted and you have mm-hmm. to kind of run on pure sort of guts and willpower because the actual fuel has left your body. And I did hit the wall in New York, and it was very hard to finish. But
I read that. You had to walk a little bit.
I did.
But you still finished.
Well, you know, I'm one of these people that if I was going to crawl, I was going to finish.
You were going to finish.
I'm not kind of a quitter, so.
That's good.
In fact, in Chicago a few years later, I had a serious IT band problem because it had gone from 50 degrees in the morning to 88 degrees in the afternoon, and both of my IT bands were locking up, and I still had 7 miles to go, and it was a very bad race in terms of time, but I was not going to not finish, and I did finish, so. If I had to stop a bunch, and but once you're out there that long, I was going to finish.
Well, you're an inspiration because I would love to try to do a marathon one day. I did the 10K training back in 2008, so I did that with the YMCA, and I felt so good after I did that race. I felt like I really accomplished something, and running is not my favorite thing to do because I think it's a little boring, but I do want to run a marathon one day, so. First, I need to do a half marathon. So you're very inspiring.
Well, I will say, you know, I had no plans to run a marathon when I started my running. And these programs, these 10K programs, and now they didn't, when I started, have a half marathon, but now they have a half marathon program and the marathon program. And as I write in the book, I signed up for it mostly to have people to run with and a place to go and a little accountability.
Sure.
And I fully assumed that after we started getting up to 10 or 12 miles, I'd have to just quit because I couldn't do it. But the program is designed, and the coaches are great, all of a sudden, just incremental, step by step, I was able to do it. So you can do it.
Yeah, you can do it. I was amazed that I did the 10K. It's amazing what your body can do. Okay, chapter 10 in your book is quite fascinating. Can you tell our listeners how Charles Colson, known for orchestrating one of the biggest criminal scandals, which was Watergate, points to Watergate as proving the resurrection of Christ?
Sure. Yeah, it's a fun thing to talk about. It's a good way to talk about the proof of the resurrection, the truth of the resurrection, because it's such an odd thing to suggest that somebody who was a convicted felon would be connected with something like the proof of the resurrection. What he talks about is, and of course, Charles Colson himself had a very sincere conversion to Christianity before he went to prison for his Watergate activities. And when he got out, he led quite a ministry for a number of years, ministering to people in prison for his whole life. Quite an inspirational person. But how does Watergate prove the resurrection?
Yes.
Is kind of the way I have titled it. What he says is, I know that Christ was risen because when the going got tough in Watergate, everyone rejected their leader.
Mm-hmm.
No one would suffer the consequences of lying for their leader, supposedly mm-hmm. then the president. But when you apply that same behavior to the apostles and the early believers, they suffered, you know, actually many of them torture, many of them, most of the apostles were put to death. There was no benefit to being a Christian in the first century. There
sure.
was no fame, there was no reward, there was no monetary benefit, and so it was very difficult to maintain those beliefs in the face of that. There's no benefit unless it was true. Mm-hmm. Unless it was really true, it would be much easier to deny your leader, to deny because you wouldn't suffer. And so the people who were following President Nixon ran for the hills and rejected him to save their own soul, so to speak, save their own hide. But the early Christians went to their death because they knew it was true. And I was talking about this point in a Sunday school class recently, and I said, you have to realize, if you lived and walked with Jesus, and you saw and knew that he had died, was crucified, and then you saw him again, how could you ever deny that that ever happened? And so it's hard, I think, in 21st century Western society to think that way. But that's, I didn't do a very good job, but that's generally how you compare the behavior of people reacting to one conspiracy, mm-hmm. in a sense,
sure.
versus, because the atheists and others who reject the truth of Christianity basically say, well, it's just a bunch of people who are telling a nice story about a good teacher, but it's not really true. And so in a sense, that's a conspiracy for them, just like the Watergate was a conspiracy. But what Chuck Colson reminds us is that, no one will die for a lie. And so
that's so true. I think that's so true. And that's why it was so interesting. It was so fascinating, that passage in the book. What role did your running partners play in your journey? You talk about a few, especially Dan.
Yeah, Dan became my running buddy in many, many respects. We ran together for 2 years. I still miss him terribly. He decided to move back to New York. He's in upstate New York, and I went a lot of miles with him. And when you run long distances, you spend a lot of time. And we weren't the fastest runners, so we were on our feet. And then one cute story I like to tell is that we'd meet Saturday morning, as we always did, and he'd say, "Oh, how'd your week go?" I said, "Oh, I was in Texas." He goes, "Oh, what were you doing in Texas?" And I said, "Oh, are you kidding? Haven't told you about this case I have in Texas." He goes, "No," and it was very crazy, odd case. And so I said, "Well," I said, "we've got 8 or 9 miles." I said, "I can tell you about it." It was a complicated, funny
sure.
story. So ever after that story, and I did, I talked the whole time. I probably talked for an hour and a half while we ran and told him all about this crazy case I had in Texas. And ever since that time, he used to introduce me to some of our other friends as his own book on tape, that just run with Bruce and turn him on and he'll tell you a story. So, but in terms of, so he was instrumental in the running part of the journey. He also had a number of questions about his own faith, and we had a number of those discussions. He had some family issues that were really testing him mm-hmm. and his faith, and that was part as well. So some of my running buddies, sort of interacted with the faith side, and others didn't.
Okay, so I mean, I think it does make a difference to have somebody to run with.
Hey, you'll do better training for your marathon if you have a.
I know that I needed that training support when I was running, because, like I said, I think it's boring to run by yourself, and I had those other people like just running beside me, and it really inspired me. I like the argument you make regarding Richard Dawkins' view on Christianity. Let's note here that Richard is a prominent atheist. Can you share with our listeners how you came to your conclusions on rebutting Dawkins' views?
Well, Dawkins has a pretty famous book now that's maybe 5 or 6 years old called The God Delusion. And he goes through almost every argument there is, for the truth of Christianity. And what I've tried to do in my book, not really in response to his book, but to pick out a number of those arguments that were important to me and persuasive to me, because I'm a lawyer, and because we are very much involved in looking at evidence and being skeptical and playing devil's advocate, I felt like I should, as I was becoming more and more convinced with a great confidence of the truth of Christianity, I thought it was appropriate to try to do my own cross-examination. In a sense, I should read people who didn't, like reading Charles Colson was helpful and persuasive, but you know, lawyers need to cross-examine the people they don't agree with. And so by studying Dawkins and other atheists, I thought I would see if my own beliefs, arguments, understandings would hold up. And so so I spent some time, and I used one chapter in the book to talk about that. But only, in the book, I only talk about one chapter. And what I talk about there is one of the arguments that I find most persuasive, and I tried to rebut his view of that issue. And that issue has to do with our sense of morality. Why are we good? And Christians believe that any standard of goodness has to be an eternal, mm-hmm. unchanging, and that that just comes from God. Richard Dawkins tries, and so the question is, how do you explain altruism if you only believe that people are the product of time, matter, and chance, that natural selection, the survival of the fittest, is the rule of the day? And if survival of the fittest and natural selection is the rule of the day, then why would anyone be kind or good or altruistic to another person? Because your objective in life, under Richard Dawkins' world, is to survive and replicate. And taking time out to give of your money, time, possessions to help another doesn't fulfill that objective. And so you have to look very hard to say, well, what's the source of that kind of goodness or altruism for someone who only believes in a materialistic view of the world? And so that's where I really challenged him, and I find his arguments to be very poor. In fact, when you get down to what biologists, evolutionary biologists like Dawkins say, is they actually say that our tendencies to be good are Darwinist mistakes. You know, that in fact they're unusual and kind of inappropriate behaviors. There is one argument that if we're kind to others, that somehow in the long run that'll also help perpetuate ourselves. But that's how the book deals with Dawkins and on that one particular issue of what's sometimes called the moral argument, that our sense of morality, our sense of what's right, mm-hmm. and our conscience, where does that come from? And I believe that, you know, there's no good source or understanding of a source of that without a belief in a God.
I really thought you made a good argument there. That was really fascinating. It seems so simple yet believable that a popular pop song and its timing in the end made you realize that you were indeed, in your own words, falling for Christ. Can you explain?
Yeah, it's I struggled with whether I was going to have the book end that way because it seems a little trite. But that's what happened. And it was just one of my typical, when I would go running, I would listen to different speakers, and sometimes I would listen to music. Actually, what normally happened was I would load a sermon or a message from an apologist, someone who I thought had good messages, and I would listen to that because that way I could take in more content as I was going through my own investigation. And I noticed that at the end of, and usually that would be a 20 or 30 minute message, and if I ran a little longer and the message is over, it would just kick into the next thing on the playlist. And it just so happened that this song was next on the playlist, and I knew it was the next on the playlist because this had happened a couple of times. And for some reason, one this day, I just was more attentive to the actual words, and the words seemed to, not that they were meant for my journey, but they seemed to reflect an awful lot of the thoughts that I was having. And somehow that caused me to finally put two and two together and say, you know, I've been resisting this commitment too long, and I know now that this is true, and this is something that I can believe in with confidence again.
So can you tell us those words?
Which words?
The words that spoke to you on the radio.
Oh,
our listeners want to know.
Oh, well, it's a silly little love song sung by Kobe Calais.
I know who she is.
And someone as young as you would. I only know who she is because my daughter introduced me to her somehow.
It's like, I think I'm falling for you.
Yeah. and I put the... it's kind of funny. I had more of the lyrics in the book, the first draft, but then they told me there was a copyright problem by repeating too many
sure.
of the actual words.
It's a really good song.
So,
well, actually, this has happened a lot where, you know, I'm driving down the road or I'm at home listening to the radio, and all of a sudden this song comes on and it speaks to me. Like, I might be thinking about something, and it's like I get my answer from the music that I'm listening to. It's pretty cool when that happens.
Yeah, that's here it is. In the book it says, I couldn't ignore the lyrics or the timing of hearing, I don't know, but I think I may be falling for you. I was preoccupied thinking about God, and it did seem as if I had been waiting all my life, and now I found you. So those are some of the lyrics that were in that song that I was listening to.
Those are great lines. What made you finally say, all right then, I give in, I surrender? The surrendering, I think, is the hardest part.
I think it is the hardest part. It's hard to tell reading the book because I didn't put lots of dates in there. But this took 3.5 years. And a good friend of mine said, Bruce, do you realize how many books there are in the bibliography? And I said, well, I hadn't really thought about it that way. And he said, well, there's 60 books in the bibliography. I said, did you really read all those? I said, well, yeah. I listened to some, and I read them all. The ones I didn't listen to, I read. And the point, I guess, is that it took me a while, and I was resistant. And I think we're all resistant. And, in fact, one of the things that made the most difference to me, one of the most memorable, important things to me, at the end, I have at the very beginning of the book, and that is, I really believe, and I use this quote in the beginning of the first, each chapter of the book starts with a quotation, and I don't know if you picked this up or not, but every faith chapter begins with a running quote, and every running chapter begins with a faith quote, because I was trying to show how intertwined these journeys can be.
Oh,
so the
okay.
the quote that I think says a lot about the surrender or our not just mine, but I really believe our inability or refusal to surrender is this quote that from Ravi Zacharias, and I listened to Ravi quite a bit, and of course he endorsed the book and wrote a foreword for me, but what he says is, the problem with man's unbelief is not the absence of evidence, but the suppression of it. And so what I became convinced, sort of retrospectively, is that I had lots of really strong evidence that should have led me to the conclusions I finally accepted. But I was suppressing that because I didn't want, for a couple reasons. Sometimes we live in a culture that is very focused on scientific evidence and rejection of metaphysical things. But also, we suppress the truth, I think, because if we understand the truth, once we accept it, there's a lot of things that's expected of us if we truly want to accept the life and teachings of Christ and be more that way. And sometimes we sort of like keeping that at distance because we're very selfish at our core.
I never thought of it that way. Are there any passages from your book, Bruce, that you'd like to read? Maybe the 11 commandments of running or a special prayer that you'd like to share with our listeners?
Well, I'll read the commandments. How about that?
That sounds great.
We've been talking a lot about faith. This is sort of focused just on running, and I tried to focus on things that really were important to me as a runner. I found that the running community, and in a lot of ways, this is my parallel to Christians. I found that my running friends were enormously generous. They didn't care how fast I ran. They didn't care if I was first. What they cared about was that I was out there and I was with them, and they were very encouraging. And I wouldn't have finished the 10K, the half marathon, or the marathons without those friends, those coaches, and that support, that generous spirit. So I say that as kind of part of what I learned, and I think some of that theme will come through. So these are my 11 commandments. Find your pace. You know, it's kind of like hikers. Hike your own hike. You know, you won't enjoy running if you're trying to keep up with your friend who just is much better.
That makes sense.
You know, listen to your body. You know, don't force yourself because you'll get injured. Enter many local races. Get a running buddy. Shop at your local running store. Join your local running club. Watch Chariots of Fire at least once.
I thought that was funny.
Join a running team or a running group. Volunteer for some local races. Enjoy the time on your feet. And whatever distance it is, go for a long run.
Those are great. You're listening to The Writer's Voice on Virginia Voice. I'm Jennifer Robbins, your host today. Our guest today is local author Bruce Mattson, and the book is called The Race Before Us. So you have some exciting things happening since writing the book. Can you tell our listeners about them, especially working with Ravi Zacharias and Stuart McAllister?
You know, it's actually hard to believe. And, you know, for those of us who believe these things, it's clearly God's hand is in this, because when I started this journey, I didn't know who Ravi Zacharias was. My friend introduced me to his writings and his CDs and things like that. And in October, just, 5 months ago, I traveled to India with Ravi Zacharias, and I spoke with him on a stage before 1,500 people at the National Conference on Faith in the Public Square in Hyderabad, India. Now, that is just too hard to believe when you
Wow.
think about that, where I've come from. So it's been really quite a journey, and I'm enjoying talking about the book and talking about my journey. But that's a sort of example. Last weekend, actually, I was in Northern Virginia helping to teach a retreat on what's called conversational apologetics. So it's opened up a bunch of new things that are very exciting and a lot of fun.
That's great, because I understand you teach that particular course at your church.
I do. I've taught apologetics and a number of other things in various Sunday school classes that we've been having.
Wow, so amazing. So, Bruce, how can we find you on social media, and what is your website, and where can we buy your book? And does it come on audio?
Well, it does come on audio. So probably the easiest, best place, and no one paid me to say this, but the easiest, best place, simplest, is at Amazon. They
okay.
have all versions. You can get a paperback, you can get an ebook, and you can get the audio in two different versions. They have MP3 download, and the book is also on audio CDs. I do have a website that has information about me and the book. And I blog a couple of times a week on running and faith topics. The blog is called The Race Before Us, not surprisingly. to find it, you would go to www.bhmattson.com.
Okay.
bhmattson.com. And I am on Twitter a little bit. I'm on Facebook a little bit. I'm not being 55 years old, I'm not as adept with social media, but I've been trying to, and I know that's an important way to do things these days.
Okay, well, thank you. I have one more final question. How is your health today, Bruce?
That's funny you ask, because I actually was at the doctor this morning, and while I still need to lose a few pounds, blood pressure is the best it's been in 7 years. So things have been very, very good. Cholesterol is at a very good level. Running apparently helps the good cholesterol. And I'm in remarkably better health than I was when I started this journey. Very optimistic about that and the future.
That is so wonderful. Thank you so much, Bruce, for being here today and enlightening our listeners. It's been really a pleasure to have you.
Well, I enjoy doing it. I appreciate you having me.
Thank you. Bruce Mattson, the book is The Race Before Us, A Journey of Running and Faith. I'm Jennifer Robbins. Thank you for listening to The Writer's Voice on Virginia Voice. Have a blessed day and evening.